Blog Talk Radio.
All right. Good morning, everybody. We got Izzy coming in here. Good morning. Look, this has been a hell of a week. First off, let me welcome everybody to Behind the Blue Curtain. And I used to say I'm your host, but I'm not. These people you see around me, this is a show where we're all equal. You know, everybody here is a host. You know, everybody here brings guests. We talk during the week. We pick each other's brains. We cry on each other's shoulders. We complain and moan amongst each other, you know, about some of the things we see. What this show is geared towards, it's not anti-police. It's not Republican or Democrat or Christian. It's we go right to the topic, and we just, when we get there, it just is what it is. You know, it just is what it is. We're not interested in anyone's feelings. It's not necessary that you send me all of your hate mail while I can appreciate the fact that you may or may not like me. That's cool. You know, what's up, B? Yeah, B over on Facebook. If y'all hear me, I'm not, like, schizophrenic. I just kind of monitor Facebook at the same time. But, you know, we just go there. And our mission is to hope that people learn. We don't do a Black Lives Matter show. You're not going to hear that here. We do not do a Blue Lives Matter show. You are not going to hear that here. We're not Republican or Democrat. You are not going to hear that here. Everybody that you see, you know, including our guests in the upper right, but everybody you see that's here is an expert. And I don't have any money. They didn't come because I look like Denzel. They came because they believe in what this show does, a place where America wants to be heard and people can come to speak. With that, I'm going to cut my stuff short before I introduce our guests and we get into it. And we're going to go around and find out what's been up with the other host lately this week. Big John, what's been up in your world, brother?
Everything's been good, man. It's been a good week for me, and I'm looking forward to getting right to the show and caring for my guests. Let's get it rocking.
All right. Let me go. Big Chief, what's up, Chief?
Hello.
Good week. Ready to get the show going. It's going to be an interesting topic.
All right. Izzy, what's up, bro? Did you get your coffee? First off, we all got the message. Did you get your coffee?
I got my coffee. I got my shot of espresso. I'm ready to go. I'm happy to be here. A lot of stuff to talk about. A lot of stuff happening in the news on the topic. So I'm ready to get into it.
Damn, bro. You doing espresso at the house? You the man. You know,
it's one of those little metal coffee pot things. Like you make like one shot with it.
Okay,
it's
yeah.
Technically an espresso.
Yeah, I got one of those. I got a Mr. Coffee. You throw a shot of rum in it. That's an espresso.
There you go. That's what works.
That's a ghetto espresso. Baby girl Claire, what's up?
Hey, good morning, everybody. What's going on?
Glad to have you.
Hey, I'm excited to be here. I'm specifically interested in the behavioral therapist, so I'm excited. Let's get going.
All right, Big Joe, what's up, bro?
Listen, after the Denzel quote, I have nothing to say. I can't top that, man. I was trying to think of something to say, but I'm done. I'm good.
Oh, you want to say something, right? That's what you want to do. You want to say something to me. Hey, look, now we're about to get into it, and y'all know I don't read a whole lot very often, but I this lady I got to read about because she earned it. And I got to say, shout out to Waco, of course, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, hometown, ATL. But I want to read this because I want to say to the people in Waco who are listening, we'll listen later, we'll download, we'll hate over the water cooler. This answer is right there. It is right there in your community. You don't have to do a council hearing, and we're going to shop around and convene a committee, and we're going to put $200,000 into finding someone. You ain't got nobody. Finding someone to bring us answers. She's right there. And I'm going to read a little bit about Dr. Corsi Cruz, our guest today. You know, she's a behavior and education consultant. She worked at WISD, Waco ISD, former Dean of Students at the Rappaport Academy, former instructor at Tarleton State University, taught junior and senior level criminal justice courses, studied educational leadership and policy studies at Tarleton State University, studied criminal justice. Oh, we're going to need that in here today, baby, because we're going to rip that up. At Tarleton State University, Master of Science. She also studied psychology. She's a multi-year graduate of Tarleton State University and has enjoyed more than 21 years of working with at-risk kids in settings from prison to residential to schools. Let that part sink in. She recently concluded her classroom and career, her classroom career as elementary educator in a local disciplinary alternative education program and a behavior interventionalist with behavioral coach endorsement. And she recently launched her own consulting business. And I love this name, Dr. Behavior. We talked the other night, and I was intending on my typical, okay, this is somebody I want as a guest. I'll tell them about me. You know, we'll interact. And I ended up on the phone with her. We talked for 4 hours. 4 hours. So, I mean, we're going to enjoy this today. This is going to get raw, but the beauty of her expertise is that we can examine ourselves, each one of us, into how we view things and why we view things the way we do and why we do what we do. With that, I want to say good morning to our guest, Dr. Corsi. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you? I'm so glad to be here. It's crazy to think 5 days ago we didn't know each other.
I know, right?
That's how it works, right?
I know, right? Well, I tell you, we're going to be set up and rolling this morning because there's so many different hot topics and aspects that are things that are going on in America right now that it's not, we can't solve it. We understand that. But maybe you can help all of us understand why we think what we think, why we do what we do, and why we say what we say. So if we can understand ourselves, maybe at some point down the road, we can focus on the problem. So we're glad to have you here. And like I said, you're in the barbershop. You just cut in anytime you want, and we go from there. The first thing I got to bring up, and I was on Judge Joe Brown's show yesterday, and I listened for about an hour and 15 minutes. And they talked about varying topics, and it was interesting. And I brought up something, and I said, you know, I want to ask this question to everybody on the panel, which there was a couple of preachers there, of course the judges there, and a couple other people. And I said, you know, I want to talk about the treatment of the Haitian prisoners in Texas, or the Haitian refugees, I'm sorry, in Texas. But I want to ask the question from this perspective. Before you answer, I want you to put down your political affiliation. I want you to put down your Black Lives Matter card, your Blue Lives Matter card. To the preachers, do not tell me if I go to the book of Ezekiel. I don't want to go to any books right now. I want to hear from you as a person, how you justify. It doesn't matter about the immigration status. That's irrelevant. How are you going to justify to me what happened to them? And how did we, as a country that is built on immigrants, get to that point? And we seem to go to that point with certain immigrants. So I'm going to open it up to the floor. Everybody can chime in. And when they chime in, Doc, help us understand in the realm of this topic, why do we keep doing what we do? And anybody can jump in on that one.
Let me light that match for you. one of the books that I keep referring to is a book by Robin DiAngelo that talks about white frailty. Why is it so hard for white folks to talk about racism? But again, of course, you know, the underlying issue still comes back to that big R, racism. Now, though this country was founded by immigrants, it was also founded on racism. But that's called what it is. But the real issue is until we can learn to admit we have a problem, we'll never get past it. I think that's basis of all therapy. We just won't talk about it. And the issue of the Haitians, they did it to Liberians some years ago, in case somebody forgot about those guys. They did it to, they were sinking boatloads of Cubans doing Miralitos, when they were shipping them over here, when Cuba said, well, when Castro said, I'm going to get you guys back. I'm going to empty the prison, but I'm going to send all the prisoners to you guys. And the law says that if their feet touch American soil, they're citizens. Now, are there some issues there that we need to address? Certainly. However, when we talk about the Haitians, the imagery was throwback to nothing less than slave catching and post-pre-Civil War issues. No one wants to talk about that.
Joe, let me insert something, because you said something very poignant that we really have to, because some people want to go back to a historic area. So let's go back there. You talked about Castro emptied the prisons and sent these people here. But King James also emptied the prisons and sent those people here who wrote on Anita, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, okay? These were not tourists in Christie, hey, bro, because knowledge is power. And you dropped the bomb right there, and I'm not going to let that bomb go by. These people did not show up in pristine dresses, starch with shiny belt buckles, carrying roses. That's bullshit. So we're going to dispel that right there.
But here, just in our lifetime, everybody forgets about the Liberians. This happened less than 20 years ago.
Hello?
The Liberians are coming here, and they're like, oh, you got to go back. Now, and again, we look at how we're treating Afghans. So what makes the Afghans so much different? A tyranny, mm-hmm. than the Haitians.
I'm not letting in the Afghan either, by the way. That's why they were clinging to planes and falling off of them in midair. Like, we're not...
I saw some plane loads coming in over here. I have not seen any plane loads of Haitians landing out over here. Now, you can say what you want. I'm telling you what I saw.
Well, the plane loads are usually the ones that are already American citizens and stuff like that.
Okay. Okay, I'll challenge. You and I can have
people from Afghanistan is being allowed over here in boatloads, and we're just letting them in free reign. There's been a lot of stories that have pointed out that that's not what's happening, and we've left a lot of them there, especially ones that helped our military advisors and helped our military over there, and we cut them off and left them there. There's been a lot of stories about that. So they're not getting a better deal than Haitians. They're just not getting those terrible photo ops that the Haitians are fucking getting.
Then we can have that debate, because I'll challenge you on that. I would challenge you to, if you believe that the Afghans got, the Haitians did not get a better deal, that's a complete lie. That's complete falsehood. And that shouldn't be allowed. The fact of the matter remains that the Haitians are getting beaten. The Afghans are not getting beaten. When they make you fall on planes, I'll give you that. But it's not that they got some, but they get a better deal. Now, whether or not you would want to acknowledge that, that's up to you.
I feel like we're arguing over two different piles of crap.
I yield you on that.
Chief, let me go down to you, Chief, and I'm curious, and I certainly want to give, I can't have you without the caveat. People want to say you're not speaking for Texas law enforcement. You're not speaking for your city or your police department. You know, you participate from the heart, and we respect that. And what I saw, I was embarrassed watching those guys on those horses.
I mean, you know, the pictures of the Border Patrol, it's not the troopers. So mm-hmm. I do know some of the DPS folks that are down there having to deal with that situation for sure. And here locally, I don't know if it's nationally, but, you know, they've shown the wall of the troopers' vehicles, you know, along that entry point from Mexico in. You also don't really see very many images of the Mexican nationals coming across in that manner. You know, there's no photo op like that. Now, it's not pretty. I can guarantee you it's not pretty down there. But I think from a systems or an organizational standpoint, I think that they're completely overwhelmed over there. I think that they don't have the needed personnel or the preparation to have dealt with the group of Haitians that came across, because they've been dealing with many of the Mexican nationals coming across, that they barely were able to handle that situation. Then you add in a couple more thousand people, it becomes and again, I don't know how they, you know, how did they arrive? Did they know that they were coming? Were they watching them as they came across to get to the border? I don't know how all that played out, but I think the border situation, it's overwhelming down there. Now, there also needs to be a sense of humanity there. So when you start to encounter these people, you've got to understand now, and don't get me wrong, there are some very bad people that are coming across, and I think we all can agree on that, mm-hmm. You know, that have some criminal history, some criminal activity, and some not-so-good intent to get into the United States. But even then, we still have to go through the human aspect of it, filter out that information and figure out who is who and what they're doing and deal with it that way. I think that, to get that accomplished in a better fashion, they're going to need a heck of a lot more people down there and a better system in place. If you've ever been down to the border, which I've been down there, it's pretty porous. I mean, there's a lot of places, entry points, exit points, and you can't cover them all. So I guess you're just trying to focus on the main ones. But, yeah, you've got to understand that, you know, these are not, this is not an invading country. I mean, it's not an invading country trying to take over the U.S. These are people trying to flee for a better life, for the most part. And there's a path to go through. We got that. But, you know, let's you know, figure out what they're doing, where they're there, use the human aspect, take care of them, right? And if they can't, or they're not allowed to come into the country, then we send them back as we should in that instance. Of course, I, you know, that's a federal issue. I deal with that. I don't know what the role is or what the rules are for people to get into the country. It's just not something that I deal with. But, yeah, I mean, again, picture's worth a thousand words. We've all seen it. Everybody has seen it. And it doesn't look good. It doesn't look good. And that idea or that photo in itself has shaped this narrative down there on the border. So it becomes something that we've got to get through. And I think there's some biases and some things of that are taking place down there that, you know, I think that needs to be addressed significantly. We talk about that all the time on the show, about those biases and prejudices that people have. You know, those are things that have got to get worked through, but I think the system is down there is just absolutely crappy. That's my opinion, because it doesn't seem to be working. And so I don't know what the end result or what the actual real answer should be there.
Amen. Claire?
I just wanted to weigh in on that, what she said, because it's got my blood boiling, to be honest with you. There may be a systematic issue, yes. I mean, I'm sure that there's not enough people working anywhere right now. Look at the economy. There's jobs open absolutely everywhere. Everywhere's understaffed. My issue is that I feel like it's total racism. I think that if you take the same situation and if you took a bunch of Muslim Americans into an airport, how would they get treated? I don't think that it would be a mosh pit, but I don't think that they would be treated like humans to begin with. I think they would all be looked at and feared of rather than treated like humans. And I think that racism right there is the main issue here. Now, there may be systematic issues. There may not be enough people there. There may not be enough training. But I think it's that what Chief Devlin hit up at the end is that personal bias that we need to work through with a lot of people that are employed everywhere.
Amen. Big John, before we go to the doctor to weave us into a realm of consciousness.
Yeah, I actually, my question is for the doctor, because we're talking about behavior. And I want to know where this arrogance comes from when you come into someone else's home and then you set up and say, well, these are my rules, and you have this attitude, go back home to someone, to other people. Where do this arrogance come from? Where do this arrogance come from where, there's certain groups of people that see this as their country, my America. Where does that attitude come from?
The easiest way to kind of quantify it is to go all the way back primitive. And I do this in all my training. So I teach people about your brain, and I teach people about how your brain processes information. If you go back to the foundation of who we are as humans, we have a small part of our brain called the amygdala. And the amygdala, the only job of the amygdala is to answer breath. That's all it does. The amygdala's job is to keep you alive. So all it's doing all day long is picking up threat. It's hearing sounds that your brain's not conscious of. It's smelling things that you're not conscious of. If you all of a sudden smell smoke, you get a full conversation, and now there's a fire, right? You immediately go to that. That's how our brain is wired, and it's designed that way to keep us alive. So it makes sense, right? We scan for threat. The problem happens when we're scanning for threats and we're seeing threats in ways that we really shouldn't. The original scanning for threat was to, you know, keep us quick, that they were, you know, that were trying to come take us out of pavement. We're now in a place where we are in charge. That we don't have natural known predators except for each other, for the most part. So now, instead of having to scan the environment for threat with animals and things that are bigger than us and all that, now we're moving to each other. We don't have known predators that are smaller. So now we're scanning for threat amongst each other. And the way that we do that is through difference. And when we feel as a part of a whole or collective, we feel stronger and we therefore feel more safe. So, you know, Clara, part of what you talked about with, you know, the individual versus the collective, I think the reason why the systemic things stay the way that they are is because the people who are in charge of the system feel safer that way. We feel safer that way. We don't want people to be taken advantage of. Oh, we really, really don't. But we have to stay safe. Y'all can hear, but we have to stay safe. You have to understand, it's about us. And that's where the selfishness comes from, because it's all about survival. It's in that primitive piece of us, and we built systems to support the powers that be, making sure that they stay safe. And that's why the system's not going to change, because me, in the position of power, have to go in and say, okay, we're willing to give it up. We're going to trust y'all to keep us safe. And we ain't doing it. We ain't. We're going to stick with the group, even the well-meaning ones, even the ones that are allies that come out and speak out and whatever. The voice isn't big enough, and the fear is there. That what if they, right? What if they? And that's what keeps things the same, because that's what we know to be true and safe so far. And it's not. It's not safe. That's the problem. That's why we have the issues that we have now. This is where we are, because it doesn't work. We've got to change this perspective, because we are safe with each other. We have to build systems that ensure it.
Wow. I want to switch gears a little bit, keeping what you just said in mind, because I got to go over and transition to Joe, because Joe, you know, it's up to his neck in murders up there that he's working. And, you know, we talk several times a week, and Joe called me and he said, my shooters are 13. They're 14. They're 15. What the hell is going on? You know, and we all know we'll give it to the baby because that's juvenile and they'll get a lesson. But he's got this burden dropped on him. And I know of your experience in dealing with, and I don't like the term at-risk youth, because I oftentimes feel like at-risk youth is those people that the select people in society say, well, they're trash, but I'm just not going to carry it out to the dumpster. You do it.
I call them at-promise.
Thank you.
I call them at-promise, too. I don't like at-risk either. I'd
love for you and Joe to dialogue for a minute, and maybe something that you give back to Joe, maybe some of the mothers and fathers up there, and the politicians in Chicago will be listening. So, Joe, if y'all would y'all go back and forth for a minute, because youth violence is big right now.
One thing I'll mention, Joe, before you say whatever you, you know, ask or speak whatever you'd like to, one of the things I've noticed about this generation, so I just started my 22nd year doing this, and I've been through lots of types of kids. We have types of kids. If you work with children, you know that it's a new breed. We talk about this bunch different, right? The bunch that's coming in right now is a different breed. They are coming in much more aware, and they're coming in giving no shits about authority. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter. It used to be if your parents had a strong personality, the children would have strong personalities. If your parents didn't, the children didn't. I've seen so many kids with huge personalities with very passive parents. And these kids are coming in challenging systems. They're 4, 5, 6, 8 years old, and they're challenging systems, and that's not fair. I don't want to do that. And then we have adults who, in my generation, we were people pleasers. We're pleasers. So we don't like conflict. We don't like issues. We talk behind each other's back. We don't like confrontation. This, our entire generation struggles with this. Leaders struggle with this. That's why they're the authoritative and want to do what I say. They don't know how to have a conversation and discourse without it being a fight or aggressive. That's that primitive part, right? Uh-oh, what if they say something and I don't know what to say back? And then we lash back, we get aggressive because we're trying to protect ourselves, right? And so we have this cycle. So people are just like, I don't even want to have the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even, why? You can't. Mm-hmm. Now we've got an entire group of kids that are coming in, and y'all, 10 and under, I'm telling y'all, this is a different bunch. They're coming in caring not 1 minute, and they'll question you in a second about it, and then look at you and wait for your response. And so we have adults now who are being questioned by children, accurately, might I say, and they don't have a response for it. So then they rely back on their position of authority and their position of power,
and
then they discipline children for having or speaking up and saying, that's not fair. It's not fair. It's not equitable. And rather than being able to look at the kids and say, you're right, that's not, what do you suggest we do about it, and get kids perpetuating a new way of thinking and problem solving, we put them underneath our thumb, tell them you're going to do what I say, damn it, or else, we send them to DAT, we kick them out of school, we do whatever, and those are the thinkers that we need in the future, the ones that are coming out. I tell people all the time, my babies are future leaders at DAT. My alternative school kids that got kicked out at 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, do you know how much guts it takes to look at your principal and tell them to fuck off? And you're 8 years old?
Mm-hmm.
Seriously, it's the leader inside that child. But because it doesn't, that child doesn't sit in our cookie cutter, sit down, be quiet, don't say anything, speak when spoken to, walk in a straight line on the right-hand side, wear our uniform, and don't talk unless we tell you what to say, then we have a problem. And that's the majority of the kids that I was getting were the kids who wouldn't learn, they didn't learn how to be quiet. And not just talking, I'm talking about talking back. As adults, we struggle with children who know more than we do.
Mm-hmm.
We struggle with
kids
outside the box. We struggle with kids who are better at technology than we are. It's like we want to be in control so bad that that's what we feel safe. But this new generation is coming in with skills that we did not have. I'm sorry, they're coming in with it. So rather than getting upset and trying to force them back into this box, the community has to come back out, and we need our village. We lost everything when we lost the village. Because if your mom and your daddy weren't nothing, at least your neighbors cared enough about you to take care of you. Your teachers had you, your pastor had you. Whoever it was saw you, they loved on you, and they loved in you, and they were going to take care of you. We've lost that. Everybody's afraid to talk about somebody else. They won't correct another person's kid. You want the kid breaking into your house in 10 years? Correct him. You know, like, we have an obligation, in my opinion, just in being in this community, to support this next generation. I think we've fallen on this habit of talking behind everybody's back about it all, but nobody actually comes together to do anything with action. And that's why this is the best way for us to try and come together and kind of mount up and just develop some type of a plan. Because these kids are out here wondering themselves. Adults are not leading these children. They are not. They're looking to their peers far more than I've ever seen before. And I think it's because the punk-ass adults don't know what to say. They don't know what to do, and they won't care.
Drop the bomb. Joe?
Some of that I agree with, some of that I don't. And let me start. Let's work backwards. First off, the ones I'm dealing with, certainly, I agree with some of that you said, but you cannot start raising your child at 15 or 16. It's late. So that's part one. Part two is we have to look at the narcotic situation and its influx or its influence on this generation. How many of these kids are narcotics related? How many kids are, as we call them, the one-time crack babies? Where we do cross and re-ed is, you said one thing and I totally agree, the fact that the nuclear family has been destroyed. Now, let's start digging, data mining and digging a little bit deeper. The fact that an 8-year-old will have the guts enough to tell an adult to fuck off is problematic. Now, should we deal with the kid or deal with the symptom? I think we should deal with the kid, not the symptom. The child probably, if you look at it on this totality, probably does not come from a nuclear family per se. So again, we agree on that issue. For me, my shooters, they're hitters. I mean, I got hitters at 14, 15, and they're good for at least the murder and don't care. As to why it happens and how it happens, again, I will tell you that we're looking at second, third generation crack. But more importantly, you said something, and let's be very clear about it. They are not afraid. Mm-hmm. Now, why aren't they afraid? They're not afraid of consequences because there are none at home. Again, I go back to base point. They are not afraid of what might happen because, as one kid told me, said, I don't expect to be alive by 20. And he's 15. Those type of interviews are terrifying, or at least they should be, for the norm. But then let's add this last aspect. At least here, and I can't talk about anyone else's prosecutors, these kids don't get, again, there's no consequences. So if I go out and at the age of 15, I know I can walk on a murder beat, then what if I'm not trying to direct this at anybody in particular, but if I'm leading a gang, just like the mob did, I know certain people were not going to be touched. So why wouldn't I encourage these guys to do that? Because three systems have failed them: the education, the family, and the law. So we got a three-strike issue here. So it's a trifecta of bullshit.
But Joe, let me inject this in, and I'd like you both to answer to this part, and I agree with everything both of y'all just said. But I got to insert this. There's also a realm of these kids who see a bullshit legal system where Billy gets probation, but Binky gets life. They see it regularly in their neighborhoods or in their jurisdictions. They see that I am more likely to be stopped, to be searched, to be shot. And that is their vision. So how much is what, and I agree with what both of you said, but I also got to look at these inner city kids who know if I'm black or brown. I have a system, not a responding officer, not a teacher, but I have an in-place system that has demonstrated that it is willing to deal with me above and beyond what it will do for those with a title or privilege or based upon skin color. That we have to put that in there too. And I wonder how much of a motivating factor that is for some of these kids. Doc, if you can, am I off base there?
Here's what I'll say about it. The problem with the system is that the individual that holds. So it's individuals' filters, individuals' past, individuals' present that affect how and who we choose the consequence. And I think that's the problem. I just posted something this morning. Dallas ISD is now changing. They're no longer doing, they're not suspending. They're not doing in-school suspensions, and they're not doing out-of-school suspensions anymore. Waco ISD tried this, kind of. That's why I became actually an educator. I was going to be one of these reset teachers to actually come into the school to help reset the behaviors. They're going to do these reset centers and have these kids on the campuses, and they're doing reset. It sounds great, social-emotional learning, all that good stuff, which is fantastic. Hear me. I'm a touchy-feely. I'm all about people and connections and all of that. That's high nurture for me. But I also teach high structure. You cannot have a system that you say has consequences that you do not effectively implement consequences.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot do it 3 years later. We have kids at BAT who get caught with a gun when they're 14 years old. They are fine. They're doing great. Everything's great. No problems after their initial arrest. 3 years later, when the court finally get around to it, they come back to us and we're like, why are you back? It's like, oh, no, I just got arrested on that gun charge 3 years ago. There's no immediacy. What we know about behavior is that if you are going to change behavior, you have to level the consequence at the behavior, not the child. If you talk about the behavior outside of the child, if you tell the child you're bad, then the child's bad, and it will then do the things that fit that description. If you tell the child that choice was bad, but you are good, and I can teach you how to make better choices, then you're not cutting the head off the minute that the child makes a discipline mistake. There's two control. Number one, we're too lenient on one side, where there's too many chances that are being given to these kids. We have kids at 9, 10 years old that we know are heading headfirst in CDC, and we know it, and there's not anything we can do about it. It feels like. But we can. We can be consistent in consequences, because those kids, they learn how to play the system. So I teach in my trainings, and people get mad at me all the time, and I don't care, because I'm just going to say it. The educational system was built by me for me. My people built the educational system for our people. That's what the system set up for. Used to, obviously, we had segregation, we had brown, we had all of the things that required us to do better. But I would argue that our schools are more segregated now than they've ever been before. Go into any neighborhood. I mean, people now get to pick where they live. We've always been able to pick where they live. If you go into schools, it feels worse now than it ever was before. But here's what I'll say. The system was set up, and people used to say, you know, black kids get a raw deal. And then people say, no, absolutely not. It's far more equal. So here's what I'll tell you. Just what's the most recent that came out in that article. It says that data shows prior to the pandemic, of students placed in out-of-school suspension, 52% were African American, 44% were Hispanic, and 2.4% were white. 2.4% of the students in DISD, Dallas Independent School District, that were suspended were white. 96% were minorities. Now, I don't know their population numbers, but at some point, we've got to look at the system. System set up, I mean, people say, well, there's plenty of black kids that you define in the system. You're absolutely right. You know who those kids typically are? The ones that have middle-class values. If you have middle-class values in this country, you define in school. You know how to be quiet. You know how to sit still. You know how to follow instructions. You know how to do what's best. You know how to talk, not talk until it's time. You know how to do all of those things. If you have middle-class values, typically middle-class white values, you define in school. If you don't, you don't. And so what schools do is we teach you middle-class white values. That's what we do. We teach you how to sit still, be quiet, don't talk back, don't say. We teach you those things because in middle-class white homes, often, that's what we were taught. So that's where we're safe. That's where we're comfortable. So that's the environment that we want. We have to have it that way for us to be safe. When kids come in and they learn how to manipulate the system, I can't get mad at them playing the system. They learn. Listen, our system's not consistent. We give you a whole bunch of chances before we get real serious. We don't do a lot to help kids or intervention programs and things. We don't put people in there who know how to work with kids. They don't get any training. In Waco ISD alone, I started doing training for Waco ISD because no behavior trainers were ever offered. They never offered any training. So I went to our behavior person and I said, I'll do it. If you need somebody to offer training, I'll do it. We did for 2 years. That's what we did. But nobody gets trained on classroom management training. Nobody gets trained on how to talk to somebody who's not from a place where you're from. That creates nervousness. That creates stress. And right told you, the amygdala, fight, flight, or freeze. Those are the only options you have when you get stressed. If I don't know how to deal with black people and I work for black folks, I'm going to be stressed the majority of the time. What type of decisions am I going to be making? One? No. I'm going to be making stressed ones. And this is the cycle that we keep coming through because we're not honest with the fact that we're not all comfortable working with each other for whatever those reasons are. We're just not. And until somebody said earlier, until you acknowledge it, you can't change it.
Big John, I see you up there. You want to jump in on this? I see you nodding. And you dealt a lot with kids. So.
Yeah. The doctor said that kids know how to play the system. We have to take into consideration that these kids have seen the system play them,
mm-hmm.
and play those that look like them. Lady justice has never been equal justice. They have seen their fathers treated a certain way, and then they have seen white fathers treated a certain way. So the system has played them before, long before they started playing the system. Okay, I'm sorry. So now we're talking about these kids, and this is Joe. I'm going to share this with Joe. They got this thing, Joe, they call clout chasing. And there's a desire with today's youth, and you can watch TikTok videos. Everybody want to be famous. And for you kids that are in the streets, becoming famous is about killing up a bunch of people. And you're only as good in the streets. You're only as good as the person that you kill. So you could get criticized, oh, you killed the white boy. The white boy wasn't going to do nothing. Oh, you killed the crackhead. You killed the dope fiend. So they clout chasing because, let's just say Izzy is a legend in the street. Someone wants Izzy under their belt. So once he gets Izzy under his belt, he becomes somebody in that neighborhood. You can have 10 murders under your belt until he gets Izzy under his belt. So there's this thing they call clout chasing that they're doing out there. And everybody, what we call casualty, is nothing but practice until you get Izzy under your belt. And this is the scary part about all of this that's in the streets. Because dudes don't respect the person you just killed. But if you killed that guy that people respect, like, yo, that's the dude that murdered him. Now you earn the streets respect. And that's the crazy part about all of this. That is clout chasing out there. And I've said on this show many times about especially in the inner city, it's a certain consciousness about who you kill and who you commit crimes against. We know that if you kill the Caucasian, you may get more time. So you get a lot less time if you kill the black or Latino. So this is people operating with a consciousness. Now, it might not seem sense, like make sense, but there's some consciousness behind who you pulled your trigger on. So we need to talk about these kids operating, and you have these drug dealers who are training these kids, like, yo, you ain't going to get nothing but a slap on the wrist, handle your business.
It's a great point, though, about unmet needs. So what you just said about clout chasing, so all behaviors are driven by needs. We have a need that creates an emotion that creates behavior. It's really simple. I have a need for respect. I receive it. I feel good. I'm happy. I continue, right? I have a need for respect. I don't receive it. I react because I need my respect. And the definition of respect is probably, that's a whole other conversation about how we define respect. But when we look at unmet needs, power, control, love, acceptance, belonging, safety, security, those are the foundations for most humans of what we need. Or, you know, Maslow has a pretty hierarchy. We've got all the different ways to look at it. But if you think about our unmet needs, power, control, love, acceptance, belonging, safety, security, everything that we do in our behaviors are driven by those things, right? I have a need for a home, so I have to get up and go to work to pay for it. There's certain things we have to do, certain behaviors because of unmet needs. And that need for clout chasing, that need is recognition. Those kids have a biological need for recognition. We all do. And the crazy thing about unmet needs are, if they're met like they're supposed to be as children, we typically are pretty well adjusted. Any lack for any reason in any of those unmet needs causes behaviors to drive them. So what ends up happening is if you have an unmet need for recognition in your childhood, if you have a parent that was critical or whatever else, and you have an unmet need for recognition, you literally will become a people pleaser, you will become high achieving, you will become whatever you need to do on a positive side to be able to get that need met. I do not get my recognition need met, so my behaviors are going to drive me to do those things. It's subconscious. It's not something that we're aware of. But if you retrace your autobiography and go back and typically the difficult things in your childhood, you can pretty much figure out where your unmet needs started and why they're continuing now. You can't get rid of them. I tell kids all the time, I'm so sorry the adults in your life made decisions for you that have affected you as a play. Because when adults don't do right by children, we create unmet needs in children that drive every behavior that they do from here on out. And that's just our reality. We all have them. They drive all of our behaviors. When we do well with them and we're pro-social, we form them in good ways. We figure out the ways to get recognition in great ways. We're a student. We, you know, excel in sports. We figure out ways to find our recognition. If you don't see those avenues, then you have to find recognition through the avenues that are available to you. And this is what, to me, it's what it throwing those things over to children. We're creating unmet needs in children that are then driving those behaviors as well. That came from us. Our inability to show love, our inability to show support, that is something that's an adult issue that gets transferred over to children, and children are doing the best they can with what they did here. They're trying to survive like the rest of us, but they don't have our full brain. I don't know if y'all are aware, but this frontal cortex of your brain, the prefrontal cortex, is not fully developed until 25. This is where we think about long-term planning. This is where we think about consequences. This is where we think about all of the things in the future and what our future lives are going to look like. The reason why kids can't see past 25 is because literally that part of the brain isn't there yet. It's there. We can do things to support and nurture it and grow it, but it's not fully developed until 25. So anticipating consequences is not something naturally teenagers are able to do. But yet we said, you're an adult at 17 and you're going to the prison for murder for life. You don't even have the part of the brain that's fully developed yet. So it's a balance between protection and it's the individual versus the collective, as far as I'm concerned. I try to work on the individual to help the collective. That's what I try to do. And then I try to help the collective understand about the individual so that we can try and work together to try and build some of this. We're broken in a lot of places, folks.
Yeah,
what
we're talking about then is a couple of people have been hitting on the feed is not grief, is mental health. I think that's an area that we totally missed the ball. we've got to hit, you know, the elephant in the room is mental health, particularly when we start talking about juveniles in the juvenile justice system, if you want to call it that, which is totally corrupt. And I see that across the country. I mean, this system of juvenile justice, I'm sorry, I don't know what else how to say it, but it's just horrible. But when we talk about consequences, at some point, based on how we want this society to function, we have to instill that. The question becomes how, where, and why, and by whom.
So for me, it's connection. For me, it's connection. When you're connected, you're less likely to hurt the whole when you're connected to the whole. When you feel buy-in, when you feel safe, when you feel like you have a part in it, you're more likely to work towards the collective. We have so many people who are not connected. They just don't know how to connect. We have parents who are husbands and wives who don't communicate. We have parents who don't speak to their children unless they're yelling or hitting or in some way aggressively correct. We aren't connected. We're not connected to our coworkers. We're not connected to our spouse. We're just not connected. We are in our bubble, social media. We can go into technology. We can go on all those things that make it easier. The bottom line is go back to the amygdala, fight, flight, or freeze. If I get nervous around you, I'm less likely to communicate with you. So I'm less likely to understand you because I've never had a real communication with you. So we've got to connect. Mental illness, anxiety comes from lack of connection, in my opinion. Lack of connection to something safe, feeling like you can have some say-so over what's going on. That's that fear. Anxiety is directly related to your fear response. We are inundated in this country with anxiety. Inundated. It's fear. One of my good friends, Amanda Rayner, she does a podcast the other night. I caught it. And she said, you know, I heard the other day that there's only two emotions, fear and lust. Think about this. There's only two emotions. Fear or love. We're called to live in love and to walk in love. We're not called to live in fear. People who believe in the Bible know that the Bible says do not fear 365 days or 365 times, one for every day. We're not supposed to be afraid, but yet we are. We operate in fear all the time. That to me is the key. When you have connection with people, you don't have to fear them.
I'm 100% behind that. And you know, that anxiety from this, well, my phone ain't showing up, but getting on your social media, being in your bubble, it's that connection piece. I couldn't agree any more with that. You're stuck at home and all you're doing is looking at that nonsense. You're missing the point and you're creating some of this issue. You're not out. There is no connection, no other human connection. You're just looking at your technology. And I think that's a very, very important point. I'm 100%
buying. Let me ask this, G. But let me ask this for. I'm going to go to Claire first, because I want to get a young person's perspective. on what she's hearing, because the doctor said something early on that we all know is 100% true, whether we want to admit it or not. You can let your 8-year-old unwrap the new PlayStation, and while you're reading directions, they got the damn thing plugged in, already logged into the internet, and they're in stage 4 to get it. You know, so we, you know, these kids are advanced, but I want to get from her as that young boy who sees so much out here right now that's going on, you know, how does she feel about what she's hearing?
I honestly totally, to be honest with you, disagree with Chief Devlin. I think that this right here is the key to opening up and getting your mind in other places besides just your hometown. I think that if you grow up in a small town and that's all you see is all these other white kids and your white self, I think that this right here opens the door to any other country, any other universe, any other wherever you want to be.
And I can catch up, but what are your algorithms? That's the problem with that, is the algorithms.
Right.
You only see what you want to see. You may have a very broad algorithm where you get to see all kinds of things, right? Both sides of the story. But the problem is the majority of people don't have that. They see what they want to see. It's whatever their thought process is. And I know Izzy's got some stuff. I know he doesn't. It's the people that you associate with, you feel the comfortableness that you get. That's what I think becomes the issue. And you know what? Claire, I love it too, fellow technology. I can see things that I never would have been able to see.
Right.
But that's just because of the way that I have and the things that I look at. It's not all one-sided, you know, ridiculousness. But you know there are people that have these phones and all they see is one train of thought consistently over and over.
And see, to your point, though, and now let's go to this part of it. And Claire, I want you in this part, and Joe, really as the senior spokesman, and Izzy, and of course the doctor, but let's go here. Let's talk about this other, we talked about the family here. We've been talking about the parent and the child. Let's talk about the blue family. The big problem in America today between citizens and police, the big struggle to I'm right and the others are wrong. If we take everything we just heard and everything we discussed, now let's apply it to the blue family where all of us were normal people before we went into the job. And by and large, a lot of people, and I've said it, in these academies, a lot of them will train these people to be afraid of anything that is different, whether it's color, social, economic class, gay, straight, anything that's different from the culture, we're going to be afraid of. And then once we become afraid, we're going to react this way. And once we react this way, say this. But most of our friends, when we come in, we have friends all over the place. Some are plumbers, some are homeless, some is junior, the crack addict on the corner. But then when we get into this job, we start whittling down everybody, and all of our friends are now blue. So as that phone is to young people, we become this blue family who doesn't want to hear from anybody but us or somebody else with a Blue Lives Matter flag and to hell with everybody else. We see that, and we close ourselves off from hearing from society, how does society feel, what does society think, and we become the proverbial experts from our perspective. And even when we can be the perpetrators of some brutality, we still claim the mantle of victimhood, and you just don't understand everything I do. No, because I'm talking about what you did. So, I mean, I really want to shift it. And in the same context, and it's not to throw police under the bus, we just spent a whole hour talking about the family. Let's talk about the blue family now. Let's go, because that does impact a lot of us, because these are family members. We've talked about gang members. We've talked about the bad kid who does this. But these are people who can walk out here, and if they don't take your life, they can take your freedom. But let's not limit it just to police. Let's talk about these judges. Let's talk about these district attorneys. If we're going to clean the fish, let's clean all of it. You know, and Claire, I mean, you're youngest here, and Joe, you're a senior here. I mean, I for you guys too, and yeah, Joe, you old as shit. You know it. Let's not act shy. You know, let's. No, I really want to hear you guys' discussion because you're viewing it from so many different angles. And then I want to get Izzy's input. And then the chief, you manage people with multiple personalities and different life experiences. And you know, well, my personalities, I mean, everybody's different. I'm an Eagles fan. You may be a Cowboys fan. But and then, Doc, I want you to weave all this passion, this American anger and frustration together. And let's take this tapestry of different opinions and values and weave a quilt. America needs a starting point, and God knows we're not getting it from major media. Claire, what do you think?
Well, that's what I mean. I think that, yeah, it's true that your feed is only whatever your algorithm is. But if you open that door to everybody else and everything else, and you open that door of awareness to what's going on around you, then you're not just stuck in that hometown that you grew up in or whatever you're doing outside, whatever your neighbor, your other white neighbor looks like or whatever they're doing, because you are opening that door. I think that education always, I'm going to always harp on education, but I think that it's a huge issue. I think that it, dealing with technology at least, I think that it, you can open the door to so many avenues. I don't think that you're limiting yourself at all. I think that if you stay in that bubble where you're comfortable, you are limiting yourself, and that's the issue. I think that if you bring that awareness early on within education that this is a white system, that some people are able to maneuver the white system, then there is that awareness there. And then you get on your cell phone, and those kids that are 8, 9, 10 years old are smarter than the adults. And then the adults can be aware that, hey, maybe they are right. How do we reform the system? And everybody gets on these things and uses this right here instead of just their pride that says, well, let me put my thumb down over this kid because they know better than me. I think that's where it all begins, to be honest with you.
Sure.
Speaking on behalf of Team Moses and his business, and just so you know, the burning bush, he's sitting right here. I got
him. Did you water?
And you know the Hebrew Israelites, and myself would like to say this. I think that our society is based on one-upsmanship. What I mean by that is we've always got to have someone else that's lower than us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a disease. Power and dominion are two words that come to my mind right off the bat. It may not sound appropriate, but it is. We look at how policing is done in the United States. It's not equitable. It's not fair. Nor is the judicial system. We don't even want to go down that pipeline. All that said, however, something that Dr. John was talking about earlier, it's funny because I'm a history buff, and John made mention of clout chasing. Interesting in turn, because if we look at a political system, what is clout chasing? People run because they want clout. If we look at the early formation of the mafia, they kill people to move to do what? To take their position. So we are in a cyclical stage, and we just don't realize it. But one of the things that I find very interesting is that this whole aspect of mental health, we really have not gone down that rabbit hole enough.
Mm-hmm.
Mental health seems to be at the forefront of everything that we're talking about, whether it be the kids malfunctioning, adults malfunctioning too, and the judicial system. All are tied into mental health at some point, at least that's what, from what I see.
Joe,
to the point of kids, no. Let me just confess, when I talk about the kids and their consequences. When I tell you I've got hitters, not shooters, I want you to be very clear on that. I got kids that are probably killed multiple times. So let's put that there and I'll be quiet.
No, brother, you hit on something and I saw Vanessa's comments and you're right. Hey, Rachel, but I We gotta talk, especially we can't talk about policing without talking about mental health. It's impossible to do. It cannot be done. And I believe if we're gonna do it, let's put things in perspective, and we gotta call some people's asses out. We're gonna start with the police unions. Okay? Some of the most powerful entities in this country, every political person who runs for an office wants to make sure that they get the endorsement of the police union, followed by the evangelicals. But they got to have the police union first. The police unions, while they're mandating all these changes and some of them lining their pockets, are not coming out and begging these politicians to put in whistleblower protection for officers. They're not coming out and demanding that mental health services be instituted for officers. And we have done on this show 7 shows on mental health. That's 14 hours, which is more than these police unions even mandate for their people to go through. And so, when we talk about the dysfunctional blue family, and right now it's time to tear their ass up. And I want to go in there on it because there are good men and women that do this job. And not all of them that snap on the street are snapping because they don't like black people. A lot of them are carrying bullshit out of roll call because the guy on your right is screwing the guy on your left's wife, and everybody in the damn room got guns. They're going into neighborhoods where they cannot help these people because you got a weak-ass city council that legislates against the needs of the people, then hides behind, well, the officer won't say nothing because by general orders they can't. And that is the bullshit. And so these officers are dealing with people who don't have nothing. Nothing. And watching them die and dwindle away, whether they're black or white or whatever, it is what it is. And they take all of that. And then the expectations of the department, you need to make more arrests. We need to clear these cases. We need to do this. We need to do that. They're balancing all of that. Then they're going home to their bills and their kids and their marriages, and they're balancing all of that. And they go in the garage and blow their brains out because nobody gets it. Why? I don't trust a damn person at the job to talk to. Because the minute I say, I need a doctor, guess what? He's crazy. He needs the rubber gun squad. We can't trust him. This is the problem. When we talk about the dysfunctional blue family, and I'm sorry, policing, you're going to have to put up your big boy pants and suck it up. More officers commit suicide in this country than die in the line of duty. That is a fact. So when you throw up these statistics that we like to throw up for all of our grants, we like to throw up statistics. To support the chief, we like to throw up statistics. Let's throw that one up there. And when I throw it up there, I'm going to say, stop telling the country the bullshit that the biggest threat to an officer's life is the citizens. That's bullshit. It is your own mental health. Why? Because your unions don't give a shit, and they're not doing anything about it. Not every union, but collectively, they're not. Too many cities don't give a crap because they view these men and women as nothing but checkers and chess pieces to be moved around the board, not to jump or win the game, but just stay in between me and a threat to my life or my comfort zone. And that's the facts. And let me get off my
mind. Let me address that real quick. And this goes to the deference and declared to a large extent, even the Ms. Cruz. The fact of the matter is we do have good leaders that take the fucking time. When there's a crisis, they step in. I've got people that I work with that we had an incident in my office that were highly affected. My staff stepped in and said, look, we need to get these guys some help. Whatever the cost is. And the first thing that bothered me was, why does it cost us?
Exactly.
It's just a problem. But the people I work for, see, I don't have a staff. I work for my staff. They don't work for me. They just don't know what I've done that shit.
They know now.
They keep me in check. Because they come to me and say, look, this is what we need to do. And that's where we get confused. But digressing a bit, when and if this national reform comes about, they got to talk about mental health for police officers. They got to talk about the well-being. They got to talk about this thing. In Chicago right now, 64% higher than the national average. Chicago's at a crisis.
But Joe, they won't, bro.
They're killing each other. We're killing each other.
I agree with you. But the police simply will not. I don't know what the hell is wrong. There are no chiefs. There are no chiefs killing themselves. It's the men and women at the problem.
No, we have one chief
here. Okay, you may have, yeah, you may have one here or there. But my point is the majority of these are men and women on the street who are out there suffering with these people who do give a shit, by and large.
I'm going to jump in on this one because this one's kind of near and dear to my heart. First off, you know, you got to break the stigma of it being so bad. I mean, we all know that. I mean, when we're talking about this, we've got to let the officers and line personnel know that you're not going to be stuck on the rubber gun squad. You're not going to be, you know, displaced in any way. So you got to and actions speak louder than words. So you got to take care of business there. The national movement, it ain't going to happen. This is going to be on an individual department level. So depending upon what the agencies want to do and how they want to deal with it, that's where it's going to really come in. So it's going to take somebody that actually gives a damn about their people to implement a program, you know. And you have to be very careful with it because you don't want it to turn into some sort of continual yearly training that everybody looks at as BS. It's got to be something dynamic and something that people are going to want to be involved in that can take advantage when they are having the problem, not only at work, but at home or wherever it may be. Is it a crisis of law enforcement? And it doesn't ever get spoken about outside the circles of law enforcement. I mean, the only times I normally hear about the police officer suicide, well, it comes up at the media every now and again. The International Chief of Police have talked about this particular incident for like the last 10 years. How do we address this issue? And there's nobody really stepping in to deal with it. This is what I've learned. It's on me. The whole damn thing is on me. I've got to come up with something to implement into my organization to keep this from happening because nobody from the state or the federal government are coming down and say, hey, chief, we're going to give you blah, blah, blah. I can go apply for a grant or I can do this stuff, but it's still dependent upon me. And not everything works. Just like community policing, there's not one cookie-cutter size that's going to fit everything for this entire situation. And it is ridiculous that we're having to go through this. I know we got into the police suicide thing, but, you know, one of the things that I want to go back to Dr. Green's telling, you know, you only know what you know, right? And so if you're not out trying to learn about other things, you're only going to know what you know. And I use that this as an example. My first job was in South Dallas. I grew up in Plano, Texas. My area was completely different from where I grew up from. So what you said is exactly right. If you have those middle-class values and norms, when you go into an area that is not that way, you do get nervous, and I had to learn very quickly. This is not me. I had to learn very, very quickly how to deal in that environment, not being from that environment. And for me, I think I did fairly well. I managed to do that. And for those officers that are out there, I'm gonna mention that those officers that are watching this, find you some damn friends that are not cops. Mm-hmm. Go find somebody else that's not in this job. It makes a world of difference to get a hobby. That's the other thing. Get a hobby. You got to do something else. You can't live the job 24/7. And I think, Stan, that lends itself to some of this issue with, you know, the police suicides being on 24/7, always thinking about the job, always being involved and replaying it over and over again. And that's not the healthy way to deal with it, right? You got to get that stuff out. You got to
understand. But before I go to the doctor for comment, I'd be remiss if I didn't add a very important and forgotten statistic. The men and women who do this job for 20, 25 years, 30 years, oftentimes straight in patrol. They didn't want to promote. They like their neighborhood. They like the people. They watch generations grow up. They go to work, and they are more part of that neighborhood than the neighborhood they live in at home, who have helped everybody. They were always there with the milk money or whatever it took to fix that problem there. But then they retired, and everybody at the job stopped calling them.
And they
smoked their gun. Or in other words, they killed themselves because they feel I have outlived my usefulness. All the love comes from the community that they worked in, but that community could be 30, 40 miles away depending on where they live. And they're so the department doesn't call them anymore. You know. And that's a big demographic of people. They're listing, I'm sure, in various cities as suicides, but they're not held as police suicides because they're now retired and separated from the department.
And that happens soften. I'm going to say early on in the career, this is when this conversation needs to take place. We start talking about purpose, right? And doing something outside of this job. Because you know it, Joe knows it. That's what they do. That's what these officers do. It's live and breathe. And Claire knows. It's 24/7 all day. I'm wearing my police underwear and police shoelaces, right? But you got to have something else outside the job. You got to have purpose somewhere else. And I think early on in the career, if you start telling these young officers that, it has the potential to make a difference further on in the career. And we don't run into those issues. But again, there's a whole lot of other stuff in the in-between, you know, where we start talking about checkbacks, mental health screening, resources available for officers when they have the problems. We all know that has got to happen. And it's not there. I don't know, Joe, you got that at your place? I mean, did they have just a great program for you guys? Or did they before you got there?
Well, for me, my hobby at one time was drinking. And you know where that got me. But you know, unfortunately, it's not in the Olympic Games of drinking. Actuarial numbers suggest that most policemen die within the first 3 years of retirement.
That's true.
I got the numbers. Between that and killing yourself, what those people have to look forward to, not me.
I was just asking, in the interim, in that career, a strong mental health program to bolster what needs to get done for these people, right? That would make the difference. That will make the difference.
And Chief, that program is there, and Claire can attest to what I'm about to say. It's there. It's been there in America. Safe Call Now.
Yeah.
And Armor Up America have been there. They're the cutting edge. They've been, you know, we've had Sean on the show. We've had Vanessa on the show. You know, there is help there. We're not saying the situation itself is gloomy. I'm saying I don't see preventative measures in place, reinforcement in place. I don't see a plan by policing to teach people that understand you're coming in to this job where you're going to see horror and tragedy and violence on a scale that your Bible cannot prepare you to understand. And you're going to be jacked up when you leave this job. So
And Safe Call Now is excellent. Sean's an excellent guy. And a lot of individual departments have them in place. But they're individual departments. You said they're not everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of great places in Texas that have some significant, very good law enforcement mental health. It's for programs in the agency.
But it can't start and end in the academy. It can't start in the academy.
No.
Get to a shooting. That's the problem.
Yeah.
It can't start in the academy and say, yeah, there's going to be all these bad things that may happen to you. You need to find a hobby and make sure that you have somebody outside of the police world to be friends with. It doesn't just end there, because there may be one day that we talk about mental health in the academy. There may be 30 days that we talk about mental health in the academy. But what do you do for those next 25 years while you're in the police?
Long-term program.
For Safe Call Now, but there's a whole stigma behind it.
Let me ask the doctor, you know, did you want to get in before I go to the doctor? Because she got so much she can put in on this.
I mean, I got nothing to rival with what the doctor's probably going to say, but, I mean, based on what Claire, just doubling down on what Claire said, in my experience and the police officers that I've talked to, there usually isn't any conversation about mental health. And there's definitely no conversation about what you're actually going to experience when you get out on the street and experience the job the way it actually occurs. I've had officers tell me that they got no preparation for just handling the stress of doing a foot chase. They got no preparation on what it's like, what it feels like to do that, and how to deal with what happens after that. There's no checkbacks. There's no, like Joe will constantly talk about this. There's no, even with field training officers, there's no conversation after that happens where the FTO goes, how are you doing? What happens? There's none of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's non-existent. And that's in small departments and definitely in major departments.
Now, I want to reach into an unusual bag, Doc, before I get to you, because we're blessed here. We got people who bring all kind of experience here. And, John, I want to go to you because I want you to explain a aspect of this conversation to where most people would listen and go, well, who gives a damn what they think? You had guys who worked for you and what you did that weren't necessarily stand-up citizens, but they were committed to you. They believed in you. They came to you. You were John the drug dealer, the bad guy in society. Okay, let's put that all out there. But there were people. So for you as a leader of a drug enterprise and a street gang, respected in the streets, respected in the prisons, how did you mentally manage all these people who you gave a shit about because they were loyal to you? How did you manage that? Because nobody's going to develop a mental health program for inmates. We can wait on that forever, and it ain't going to happen. How'd you deal with that, bro?
Well, first of all, Stan, there's a lot of broken people, and that's what we're dealing with. You know, I actually taught guys how to recruit. And they went out and recruit. I actually learned from studying the Nation of Islam. They had what they call fishermen of men. And some of these kids came out of, I don't know if y'all familiar with Greenwich, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the richest people in the world live in Greenwich. And some of the kids come from out of those homes. And what you have is a lot of people who don't know how to think for themselves. So I used to get paid dues every week. And that due money never went back to the gang. It went back to me, and I took care of my captains and lieutenants who kept everything in order. And I look at it as people who didn't know how to think for themselves was paying me to think for them and to make the decisions. And the difference is that with me, it was consistency. Like, parents who want to smoke weed with their child on Friday and then discipline them on Saturday. Children look at them, well, oh, mom, you was just smoking with me last night. Now, how's it going to discipline? So one thing that I did notice that kids would take disciplinary from me. So if there was an incident, and dudes came back to, yo, this is what it was, and I handed down the discipline, they accepted it. And they respected it because the fact that I was consistent. I wasn't hypocritical with them. So it was pretty much easy, Stan, to control the way people think because, like we talked about consequences. If I'm a young black kid, I'm coming up, and I see that this black actor got this jail time, but this white actor didn't get arrested. I see there's no consequences for certain people. So it's easy to manipulate that type of thinking. It's easy, and that's all it is. You play on the side of these young kids, and you win them over. And it don't take much. People think they're there for the money. It's not that they're there for the money. It's because of the environment that you create. And if you can create an environment where they feel safe there, they know that you're a loyal one, they know that they can trust you. This is one of the topics we was going to talk about was trust. You know, there was, I put it out there, there was dirty cops. And although they came and provided information that was beneficial to me, I didn't trust them. Because you took an oath to that blue uniform and you're disloyal to that blue uniform, what the heck makes you think, if we think you're going to be loyal to me? You ain't even loyal to the person you took an oath with. And it's no different from the cop who has a snitch in the street and he's working that snitch, That cop don't trust that snitch. He's using them until he can't use them no more. He's using them, and then he's going to look at him like, well, I know I can't trust this kid because, man, he just gave me everything about his game. Well, I view police the same way. So it's understanding the psyche of people, man, and I never went to school for it, man, but it's not that difficult, man, when you understand circumstances and situations, man, and winning someone over, man, it's not really hard in these times, especially when we get back to the homes that are broken and destroyed, and, you know, whether it's drugs, whether it's, you know, just the families are shattered. Parents are working so hard that they're not giving the time to their children. I have time for your child. I have time to sit down and talk to your kid. You don't. I don't. I know what to say to them to win a moment. So, you know, I don't know if that's really answering your question, Stan, but that's just something I wanted to talk about, man, because we did talk about trust and all that, but I just wanted to say that to you.
Let me do this, John, because I want to first off say to the Facebook Live people, you know, on this show, we're so damn used to Facebook, we're not shocked by anything Facebook does. The live is still going, but they kicked everybody out of the live. You know, but that's Mark Zuckerberg. But that's okay, because we're still going to do the YouTube and put everything up. And the funny thing is, after I end the live, it's viewable for everybody to look at. They just didn't like the comments and the information being exchanged, and because maybe we were a little too proactive or too positive. We're at the 38-minute mark in this, and we could do several shows with all of us here in our experiences, especially with Dr. Corsi, and it's no disrespect on other guests we've had on, but it's very rare that you get a professional that would drop an F-bomb and drop a few appropriate, because shit is what it is sometimes, and that has lived what they say. You don't get that. You usually get the, well, you know, lay on my, this is my couch here, it's leather, lay on it, don't, you know, take your shoes off, don't put any marks on. She's straight up, and she's hardcore, and Joe, Izzy, me, the Chief, John, we don't all agree on everything, but you know what we agree on? There's a problem. That's more important. We did a show 2 weeks ago where here we talked about the act or the actor. What are you outraged by? The person who committed the murder or the murder itself? And, you know, Zach, you heard a lot, and hopefully we're going to get you back. But you heard a lot here today. And America is jacked up. It's evangelical. It's anti-evangelical. We've got black folks over here, white folks over here, Republican, Democrat. Let me get a caller real quick. We got one in here real quick from the 832 area code 0764. Good morning.
Good morning. It's Daryl Phillips.
What's up, Daryl?
I wanted to we were all talking about the mental health aspect of everything going on. And I'm a retired officer, and I understand that part. So now I run a mental health program for teenagers in the Chicago area. And we just had a lot of killings of teenagers, so it hit home because it was a classmate. So one of the kids in my camp told me this. He said, your program is great for a few hours, but we can't protect them at home. And that's the biggest thing. We can give them all the mental health there is, but until they're able to get out of that situation, that's the problem. So I just left the group, and it's like a call to action where people are really ready to take their neighborhoods back. There was a young lady that was killed from somebody stealing a car, ran off the road where she crashed her car. So, you know, accountability for the people committing these acts, there is none because they have no fear. They don't fear the police, and there's no leadership on the streets. And the kids in the school can tell you that. So that was my whole take on the thing. We can do everything we got, but until we change the situation, like somebody said, it's like going to an AA meeting and then congratulating them by taking them out to a drink.
Yeah.
because that's exactly what it's getting to with some of these programs in the inner city.
But, Daryl, let me ask you this. I think it's time for people like you that are doing the work, that are doing the hard work. I mean, hell, dude, you're a retired police officer. You put in enough. You've been there. You've done enough. And you're doing more. Where are all these preachers? And I'm going to go there because I think all of us on here who have been police officers can say, in the inner city where we have the most crime, there is a church and a liquor store on almost every corner. The liquor store is open after hours. The church is closed. I'm not knocking Christianity. Don't anybody call me because I'll tear you up. Don't call me talking about, well, my pastor. I'm not talking about your pastor. I'm talking about there ain't enough. There ain't enough. Close the church down and let's put a power program in there. If you're not reaching out into that community but three times a week, Wednesday, prayer study, Saturday, choir practice and fish fry, and Sunday for service to take money out of the community, then shut it down. And I'm telling you that from somebody who lived through the 60s, where our church was our city hall. We went to church on Wednesday. We learned about the council meetings. We learned what was going on in the neighborhood. Then we had Bible study. That came after we established all of that. That part is gone. The church today has become a fundraiser, a political caveat to have on your resume. I'm an evangelical Christian. Vote for me. That comes before I learn anything about you. And so, Daryl, I mean, God bless you, brother. I mean, until we get the city council people who give a crap, and that comes from the citizens, if, as long as you're voting color, you're voting, oh, they're black, we need somebody black. Well, they're in your neighborhood and already they ain't doing shit. And you're going to vote them in? Or we need a Democrat. Well, you got a Democrat in there that's not, or a Republican, whatever. My thing is vote, become an educated voter. To the facts. To what is real. To what happens to you. To what's relevant in your neighborhood. Have some input. If you don't know the name of your chief of police or the sergeant that's over the district that your house is in, or the three officers, day shift, afternoon shift, and night shift that work your area and keep your property safe, don't badmouth the police. They know who the hell you are, but yet you don't know them. And I'm only asking you to know four people, the three officers that work the area and the sergeant. Come on, John.
I just want to say, Darryl, have you tried adding the parents to whatever programs that you're running? Because this way they are able to bring back from what you're teaching, and now it's in the home. I think you raised a valid point about the kids that, you know, we're good while we're here too, and then 15 minutes later we got to go home, and then go home and bullshit. But if you bring the parents into some exercises, I think that you is a continuation of your program, and you build a bond between that parent and that child because now they have exercises to do together.
Well, no, when we say home, we mean back to the community. We have the parents involved. What we're saying is their biggest struggle, these are the kids that's doing what they're supposed to do. These are the kids that go to school. Their biggest thing is, when I graduate high school, I'm moving. I'm leaving Chicago. So their biggest thing is to and from school and while they're at home. And they'll tell you exactly, because I asked. I said, is there problems in school with gangbangers? They all looked at me and laughed. They was like, gangbangers don't go to school. They gangbangers. And that thing is like, we're the victims because we're going to school and we're caught up in their arguments that they aren't even a part of. So that's their biggest fears. The big that's the problem that we have.
Right now.
And you all don't worry about that. I'm recording this because I can't depend on Facebook, you know. But
which is leadership. And we're not just talking about your national. When I went through my doctoral program, they took us to D.C. for 7 days. And they showed us behind the scenes of how laws get made and the grassroots and the lobbyists. We got to meet with both sides of everything, and we saw the behind the scenes of D.C. And we met with Dr. Chen, who was born in Chief of Staff at the time. And we started talking to her about education. We're all doctoral educational, you know, leadership people, right? We're coming to D.C. to see how, you know, we can create the change that we can see. And the direct feedback that we got was, D.C. and Washington is not concerned about education. It's a tier three topic. It's a tier three topic that no one will ever vote for and no one will ever vote against. There's not a single thing that the federal government is going to do for us for education. Is what we were told directly as educators. They told us that if we wanted to create systemic change and if we really wanted to see something happen in this country on a big scale, then we needed to go back not just to our districts, not just to our schools, but to our into our own classrooms. So what I would argue is, it's a leadership issue that starts at home. You have to take personal responsibility for your own mental health. You have to do that for yourself. When you know that you're not right, when you know that your reactions are immature or your reactions are old habits that you have not learned how to do something different and it's affecting the people around you, you have to get help for that. That doesn't mean you have to lay on someone's couch. It can literally be talking to someone who has enough know-how to be able to say, that's inappropriate behavior. You don't get to talk to people like that just because you're mad. We have to stop giving excuses to people because we empathize and, oh, yeah, I felt like that too, so it's okay for you to do that. No, it's not. It's not okay for us to have yelling and screaming and aggression that's happening in all of these homes across everywhere. This is where people are living in such a high-stress environment. We are stressing the hell out of these kids. We're stressed. We're stressing the kids. The kids are coming to school. The teachers are stressed. The administrators are stressed. The police officers are running the school is stressed. Everybody's stressed. Nobody knows how to deal. Nobody knows how to deal. Learn how to deal with yourself. The best strategy I can give you is this one. It takes 7 seconds for one deep breath. You do 8 of those, that's 56 seconds. 7 to 8 deep breaths is an automatic brain reset. It doesn't matter how upset, how angry, how sad, how mad, wherever you are, 7 deep breaths, less than 1 minute, gives you a full emotional reset. You can spin yourself back up if you go back to it. It's a reset, 1 minute reset. Imagine what happens if we take a few deep breaths before we respond, before we react. How many victims are we creating with our words because we can't handle emotions? Because we feel stressed and we can't take a deep breath before we unload on other people. So leadership is the issue, but I argue that leadership starts with self. You are your own leader. We have leaders that, yeah, we create these programs and the leaders are like, oh, that's bullshit, that old bullshit ass, whatever that attitude is. Well, you're expecting people to want to go, oh my God, you finally created the bullshit ass program that everybody's looking around saying is stupid. And now we sit back and now I don't even have that program. Mm-hmm. And it was all because the person that I trusted to lead me in an organization took a poo-poo attitude about it. Our leaders have to get excited about this because we don't like change as individuals. As humans, we don't like change. Remember, I told you that fear thing is change. That means it might be bad. It also might be good. So at some point, we have to, as leaders, step forward and negate all of the negativity. We know there's a problem, so we create a new program. I've been the new program, by the way. I've been the new program coming into change. And I was dead in the water before I even started. The attitude from the leadership was so crappy that nobody even wanted to talk to me. We're doing this stuff to ourselves. Take it from leadership in police departments and in your local communities and now take it back to your household. If you have someone in the household that's creating an unsafe environment for anybody, including emotions, if you can't talk in your own household for fear of whatever's going to happen, you are who we're talking about that is set up for all of the nastiness that's coming. You're in it because you don't know how to communicate. And then you overreact. You don't accept responsibility for your decisions. You blame everybody else because they made me mad. We get in this habit, and because, yeah, they made me mad too, I support you in that. No. Nobody makes you mad. Anger is a secondary emotion. It's still something else. You choose to get mad. If you choose to get mad at bad things happening, you got to own that. That's what you're
Amen.
Saying.
Amen.
You have to do more of this. Stop trying to shield people from the consequences that they earn. If they earn the consequences as a leader by God, that's the best thing you can do for anybody. You do no favors for children on us. If they earn a consequence and you don't give it to them, it's exactly what I think John said about, you know, knowing that, they're not trustworthy. As a leader, I knew that my boss was not going to write me up if I came in late. Everyone. So I tested it. I pushed it. I did things that I normally wouldn't do because I knew I was safe. Other people do the same thing. When we create these environments that support the wrong thing, we can't get mad when all we get is the wrong thing. At some point, leadership has to step up and decide what this attitude is going to look like, and then we have to live it. We can't do the soundbite mouthpiece and then behind closed doors, that just don't work.
Yeah.
And we
yeah.
can't figure out why nobody can break from the program. We just wasted all this money because we do this because it makes us uncomfortable because we wouldn't be the ones to go do this. Well, what about the 97% of your people who might if you would be on board with it? We can't, that discretion thing about everybody gets to make their own decision and it's up to your discretion and we support it, that to me is what's getting us in trouble because we don't have hard boundaries. We don't have hard consequences. And we don't hold people accountable. When kids know that you're going to hold them accountable, they stop messing up. They don't have to keep trying it. They know what's about to happen. If they never know if you're going to consequence them on, are you going to do it today or not? You going to do it tomorrow or not? It becomes this weird dance. If they know every single time, they stop doing it because they already know what's going to happen. That's where the high structure has to be partnered with the connections and the nurture. If you don't do those things, then you don't have trust, and people won't follow you.
Whoa, somebody dropped the mic. I do it. Well, you know, I mean, I'm sitting back at Notepad 4. I'm just gonna rely on the audio after this. You know, I mean, I'm listening to you and I'm looking at my police struggles and my personal struggles because when I came out of policing, even though I was a community police officer, I had to reconnect with civilian society because before I was a police officer, I was in the military. I don't understand what I think. It's right or it's wrong. You do it or you don't. It's not that they're wrong or I was wrong. And I had a frustration there. What are you complaining about? You're getting paid. Do what you pay, you know. But, Doc, you know, having you here today, and we didn't get into a lot of specifics, and I'm glad we didn't because I wanted it very general because I want people to be able to take away something. And people have a bad way of saying, well, police never did me wrong, so I'm not listening to this show. When they're missing what they need. Or white people have never done me wrong, or black people have never done me wrong. So they tune out, and they miss what they need. You know, and for you to come here with all the knowledge, and what really shocks me personally is that you're right there in Waco. And while your phone is not blowing up, by all the school districts in McLean County, I don't know. It's not a thing to push you or publicize you. I'm not paying her to be here if she didn't pay to be here. Because ain't none of us on here got no money. Maybe her, I don't know. But the rest of us, I can tell you, we ain't got shit. You know, we don't have nothing by a cripple crab or crutch. But we're here. And you guys today got firsthand. How we think, why we think, why we do what we do. America is so dysfunctional today, unnecessarily. We all know that it's jacked up, but we just can't quite grasp why. What we heard today, why. Maybe it's us. Maybe it's not the Republicans or the Democrats or black folks or white folks or the police or the gay people or the straight people or the evangelical. Maybe it's us. Maybe it starts with you, and we're at the 20-minute mark, so I want to go around and give everybody plenty of time to chime in before our guest takes us out. And Big John, brother, come on. Come in, Ty. Give us your final thought.
Well, I think this was a very informative show. As always, I want to thank our guests, as well as my co-host, At this time, I'm going to shut up because I want to hear from Izzy, because I know he said at the beginning of the show he got some information, and I'm going to shut up and save him some time.
Speaking of the devil, Big Iz. Come on, bro.
When did I say I had some information? The doc got all the information. I'm just a reporter, man. I mean, great show as always. I will say that whole the idea of individual responsibility is important, but we've got to temper it with a little bit of understanding that systems that are in place, at least in my opinion, benefit from that narrative of individual responsibility. Why, you know, everybody's running to recycle compost. Meanwhile, major corporations are responsible for like 70% of the problems that were in our environmental level. So it's easy for them to pass it off and say that we have to take the first steps in individual responsibility because they take advantage of that. Stan said that, you know, people should be going out and finding out who their police sergeants are at the local precinct and who their chiefs are. I agree with that to a degree, but by definition, policing is a service industry. And I worked in the service industry, and I'm not comparing waiters to cops, but I'm going to tell you right now that I don't wait for the guests to come to me to tell me that they're ready to order. Okay, so the cops, the police department need to be taking that first step and stepping into the communities. And if it comes down to something as literal as knocking on doors and being like, hi, I'm your chief of police, hi, I'm your sergeant, then that's what needs to happen on a systemic level, because police departments are benefiting from that individual responsibility narrative. They can get a pass and keep doing what they're doing because, oh, what did you do? You didn't try and meet me. You didn't try and come and talk to me. Now, if they host the events and they do the stuff they're supposed to do and then people don't show up, that's the meeting. But the responsibility, first and foremost, is on the leadership to make those first steps and to be the leaders and to come forward and to present themselves. And I think that, I mean, when you bring up the individual responsibility part of it, it's up to us to pay attention. I mean, we talk about whether or not national police, the conversation on national police reform is going to happen. It's not. It was killed this Friday. Dead.
Mm-hmm.
Done.
Absolutely.
It's not happening. And you can argue about it, and you can go with the politicians and say, oh, we just couldn't come to an agreement. Or you can, in my opinion, you can be like me and just be like, were they ever really intending to reach a solution? Or was it all about optics and looking like they're trying
right.
So that they can get the votes for the next election so they can keep their jobs?
Yep.
So that's where the median is. Like, the systems leaders need to step forward, and we need to pay attention and make sure that they're stepping forward. That's all I have.
All right, brother. Appreciate you. We're going to go down to little lady Claire. Come on, girl. Your thoughts.
No, I pretty much forfeit my time because I agree with everything Izzy said. I think that it starts with leaders. I can't harp on it enough that individuals can only do so much, especially in the policing, especially coming in as a new officer. You know, you can educate yourself as much as you can, but if you don't have the leadership there or the system there to support you and support that value, you're not going to make it very far alone.
All right. Appreciate you. Let me go down. Let me see. Big T. Come on, bro. Give it to us, Chief. I know you got a full plate.
Well, we'll have to do another hour, but I'm not going to be here for another hour. No, it's true. The leadership, they're the ones that are driving this bus. And just like the doctor said, you know, you get this great program in there, and behind closed doors, you're like, that's a bunch of crap. We're not doing this. And then why implement the program to begin with? Yes, the leaders need to be excited. They need to be part of the program. They need to be out there pushing the program. They need people to understand the program and why there's importance. And I think, you know, everyone on the screen here has been part of something like that where they know they're going through a BS program, right? We all know about it. It's up front. We see it at the very beginning. So if it's something that's that important, when we start talking about the mental health issue, the aspect of it, and that needs to be driven from the front, you know, and proven that the stigma is not there. It's not going to happen all the time, you know, as far as law enforcement is concerned. It's just going to continue on. I think it's pretty much all I got. I should have written so much stuff down, but Doc, hey, everything you said was fantastic. Couldn't agree more, and, you know, I think you're spot on almost everything you said today about those connections. I think that is absolutely important.
All right, Chief, I appreciate you. Let me go, Big Joe.
Well, again, for Team Moses, I'd like to say we'll take it for 4,000 and one. But we'll figure, you know, we don't need to be the board. We don't need to be the collective. But the real issue for me is that in this business, we have taken it to the point where everything is black or white. And that's just not the case. And that's where people fall down at. They fail to recognize that there is a gray area. That's how you get case law. That's how you get Terry versus Ohio. That's how you get Miranda versus Arizona. But failing to recognize that there is a gray area that can operate and not exclusive of the other two, it's where I had the problem. But I don't want it to be the board, the collective thought running around in space saying, oh, we're all thinking the same thing. No, that's what makes us. And I'm done.
All right. Doc, take us out of here. Final thoughts. Go ahead. We got about 8 minutes. Come on. Take us out.
I won't need all that. What I'll say is leadership is extremely important. My doctorate is actually leadership. I'm not a licensed counselor. I have kids go through licensure, but my doctorate is leadership, and I am very critical of leaders. I think that when you accept the position and the power and the money that comes with it, I think that you absolutely are in service to your stakeholders. And if you're operating in any way outside of that, you are a part of the problem. Servant leadership is my thing. It's how I live. It's what I was doing long before I knew that there was something called servant leadership. I have never asked anybody that I have ever supervised to do anything that I have not personally done myself, and will do it right alongside everyone else. And because that is how I choose to live my life, I'm acutely aware of the struggles that my stakeholders are dealing with. And so I'm constantly, as a leader, looking for problem solving. I'm looking for ways to make things better. I'm looking for ways to make things easier. As a school administrator, I would walk through the building at 6 o'clock and pick my teachers out. You do not need to be in this building any longer. Go home and take care of yourself. Get yourself something to eat. And spend some time with your family. This stuff will be here tomorrow. At some point, we get so locked into our titles and our positions and this arbitrary expectation or standard of what we have to meet or whatever our quota or whatever the expectation is, and we lose sight of the fact that we're doing it on human facts. If people are not told, you are setting yourself up for liability as a leader. You have to deal with whole people. And as a leader, you need to be looking for ways to help people and to encourage people to be whole. One of the stupidest things I've ever seen in my life is as educators, we go through all this professional development training. We are sitting in classrooms all day long, and they give us a half a day to fix our entire classroom. You sit us through all these trainings, 10, 11 days worth of new and old and same old training. But yet you give me no time to even work in my environment. What are you saying about your care and concern for me and the children that we're fixing to invite into this building? Teachers have to stay after overnight almost to be able to get their classrooms ready because time is not available when they get paid for it. We don't get paid to set up our classroom. We have an empty room where there's nothing on the walls. We supply all of those things. That's from just an educator standpoint, not to mention what police officers do and how much they come out of pocket and buy a car seat for somebody so they don't have to give them a ticket because their baby wasn't strapped in because they don't have one. I mean, we've all seen those stories and those still good stories about leaders that step in and step up. More of us have to take personal responsibility from a leadership standpoint to care about our stakeholders. But from a whole, we have to take personal responsibility. If you know that your childhood was jacked up and you've never talked about it and you've never dealt with it and it's affecting your communication with your spouse or your children, go talk to somebody about it. Go talk to somebody about it. There is no stigma. The stigma is being an ass at home and creating another generation that's terrified of their shadow because their dad doesn't know how to communicate without being anxious and angry.
Amen.
We have to do better. And I can point fingers in 52 different directions. The minute somebody says, well, of course, you have this, well, you, them, they, we all do this, and then we get stuck in the mud. We start talking about an issue, and then we point fingers somewhere else, and we don't ever have to look at ourselves. So what I've chosen not to do is I do my personal work. I do retreats. I do individual for myself. I go spiritual retreats. I have my own meditation. I walk in nature. I connect back. I know who I am outside of that. I know who I am outside of my life. So I strongly encourage people to do your personal work. get to know who you are and why you are. Ask yourself those questions. Why do I always react that way? I don't like that about myself. The mental note from Dr. Behavior is tell the thought no. You have a thought that you don't want to have that doesn't serve you, no. Then pick something else. But we have to stop being so reactionary to everything. We have to be more proactive. Proactive comes from a leadership standpoint and us giving a damn about the people that we are paying to lead. And then it has to come from a personal responsibility that I have to offer the best me to you to connect to. We talk about connections all day long, but if there's nothing to connect to, what really are you connecting with? We have to be able to bring something to the table. And so many people are broken and then they want somebody else to come put the pieces back together. And that is not how this works. So from an individual standpoint to a leadership standpoint, can we all take personal responsibility and admit that we don't know everything, that we don't have it all figured out, and we need help. We don't have this whole human thing figured out and how to manage ourselves. There's people out here who went to school for a really long time who would love to help you. All you have to do is reach out, and I promise you, it will get better. It doesn't have to stay the same.
Hey, Doc, before we get to your social media where people can follow you, let me just add a caveat in what you said. When you find yourself wanting to help people, and we like to go on this cliche, oh, there's so much, I don't know where to begin, oh my God. The least of the people. Go find somebody who has considerably, not just less than, because that may make you go next door, because they drive a Chevy, you drive a Ford. Go to the least of the people and start there. Not for social media, not for recognition, not for the Republicans or the Democrats, not for Christianity and your God. But because you had a desire in you to help someone, not a Christian, not a straight person, not a gay person, not a Republican. You just said, I walked out my front door. I'm going to help somebody today. And go with somebody. It may be a police officer who makes more than you. It may be a homeless person who looks or does not look like you. We don't get to be the people who choose who we want to help and then want to benefit spiritually from it. Eat what's on your plate. Take what is given to you. These people, Joe, the Chief, Claire, John, Izzy, they're here, and I'll say this. It ain't because Stan is pure and Stan, because Stan got demons. I got, you know, my stuff I deal with. But you know what each one of them brings to me? Something that Stan lacks. That's why they're hosts on the show. It's not because Stan is great. Because Izzy brings something to me that I go to that makes Stan a better Stan. Joe, the Chief, John, Claire. Yes, Claire. This little girl, you had 24 years in when she was in the police academy. Claire taught me a lot. And until we as individuals figure out that, you know what, we're jacked up. We ain't got all the answers. Hello, somebody. And you need people to make you the you need to be to get to wherever it is you want to be, whether it's heaven, the life beyond, or nowhere afterwards. You ain't going to get there without people. And if you want to live a peaceful life, you ain't going to get there without people. But it's all about the people you keep around you. And, you know, Doc, I appreciate you being here. The time, of course, it always flies on the show, and it always goes quick. And, you know, I got to say, I want somebody to have the final word on the show, because, and I'm going to take a personal minute. It means a lot to me that they be the last words that are here. And before I go to that person, Doc, can you tell people where they can follow you and reach out to you?
Sure, absolutely. So you can find me on Facebook is the easiest way to get to me. My email account is just cruz4c, so it's just in reverse, cruz4c@gmail. It's an easy way. All of my contact information is on my Facebook as well. I'm on Instagram, just not as much. I'm in the process of working on my website, get everything up going, and when that is up, it will be drbehavior.com. I'm spelled out D-O-C-T-O-R, behavior.com. So that's coming as well. I was an educator 3 months ago and decided to end off in that space and move into a new realm. So everything is blowing up right now. So I've got a teacher course that's at MCC in November 11th. I'm doing a course there for teachers. It's all about brain-based supports and strategies. I'm also doing one for parents, and I've got one for leaders as well. So I'm trying to teach everybody about how the brain works and how to stop shooting themselves in the foot and how they communicate. And to make things a little better and how we're communicating and understanding people. So that's where I am.
All right.
Thank you, Jane, for everything.
Now do this for me, Doc, because I got time. Don't worry about it. Give me about a minute and break it down slower for folks who say, I didn't catch all that, because they will. And they, you know, we can rewind to hear it. But what I really want to do is I want you to give that minute. You and I connected. And we met just off a random post you put up, and I looked at it, and I'm like, what the hell? And this lady's right there, and I researched you. So, I mean, I want people to know that God will bring people in your life you need when you need them, if you're open enough to receive them. If you would, take your time. How do we meet?
So I received a message from you that said I shared your post about your class, and I knew of you because obviously I've been in Waco 15 years, so I knew of you from when you were here before. And I thought, we're not Facebook friends. And so when you reached out, of course, you know, I'm all about getting this information out. So of course, I'd love to. So we reached out, we communicated. And what started off as a very kind of get to know you and kind of get to know attitude, personality, kind of did you talk about topics. Within probably 2 hours, we had shifted from this kind of a conversation over to a spiritual one. So one of the things that I do as Dr. Behavior, I have this side of things, but I also have the spiritual side. So where I personally believe all this stems from is from our spiritual side, the flesh and the spirit battle. So that's a huge piece of what I do as well, but this is the part that everybody's comfortable with. And so, you know, I can help you on mainstream kind of things, but from a spiritual standpoint, I believe that it goes deeper than that. I believe we have internal conflict and struggle that we fight between light and dark, and that's the root of the majority of all of our issues. And when we start that work on the inside and become more light than we are dark, the whole world will light up. And so that's the conversations that you and I were able to have about that personal responsibility and being able to be the light ourselves. I can't walk around and scream about how dark it is and I never turn my light on, right? I can't complain if everything around me is negative if I'm contributing. So that's where that personal responsibility to be comes in, is just taking that and understanding that it may be a lot deeper. And if you have a spiritual foundation, there's a lot of conversations you can have about that that can really help you in knowing how to do it yourself and not necessarily needing a counselor to do it. So that's another aspect that Dr. Behavior offers as well, and that's going to be coming online pretty soon. I'm really excited about that because that's more of the newer side, and I'm getting a lot of...
Well, we're going to help you with that. And you know, I got to say, that conversation wasn't 2 hours. It was four. You know, I looked at my phone. I'm like, oh my God, it's 2:30. You know, but we went a long way. So you know, as we do every week, you know, someone closes out the show, and this ain't the Stan show. You know, it's the world show. And so Claire, you didn't even know it. Watch your eyes. She's like, what, Claire? Yeah, you get to take us out this week.
Claire, can I say one thing before you do? I'm going to give you a pause so you can think about what you want to say since you put you up with that. What I want to tell you all, though, is after a 4.5-hour conversation with Dan, I can tell you that he had as much passion in the conversation about himself and his own self-improvement and things that he needed to do to improve as he did. And as y'all see in this show every week, and as y'all know him in that connection. So I can just tell you, I was a stranger that he started a conversation with and was fully able and willing to be vulnerable and transparent. And I think he got some really great things from that. So that stands for you, Sam. That is a huge thing for you as a leader as well. You're not just talking the talk. You're willing to walk the walk as well. And you're willing to look inside as much as you're able to look outside. So kudos to you as a leader, being different and not knowing me from before, that you're walking it. So kudos to you as a leader. Sorry, sir. Thank you.
No, I was actually going to ask if Joe wanted to close it out.
he looked like he had something he wanted to share.
He can share, but
no,
you go slow.
No, it's on you, babe.
Yeah, baby girl. See, Joe is like me. You got two dads. Joe is like that other dad. But I was there when he was at the poker table. No, you know, you got, I mean, on here, you're our baby, police-wise. You're our baby girl. And there's a part of our blue spirit that embraces you. And we protect you there. But then as just being men here, we respect your courage to speak up the way you speak up. I've talked to Joe. I know the chief. I know how John feels. So you're not the female on the team. You're not the baby cop on the team. You know, we respect you and we love you. And like I said, you're not a co-host. You're a host.
You're a badass.
Yes, he is.
Well, I was going to say to Dr. Cruz, I am in a school for counseling, so there is that option too, but it always starts with looking at yourself first. That's the most important thing. That starts with awareness. It starts with looking at yourself first as the individual, as compared to the collectivistic view of who your family is rather than coming from that point of view. I think everybody needs to look at who they are and what that means to them. So with that, I will end the show.